is our fourth week on our series on the Creed. We're not going through the scriptures at this time, but reading a liturgical text, which is always appropriate. And we're not getting too far. It's our fourth week, and we're still on the first word, credo, I believe. And just to recap, I began the series by reminding you that belief is not cognitive rational knowledge, but belief is accepting something as true on the authority of someone else. We would love to have cognitive rational knowledge about God, but God is God and we are not, and we can't. And we live by belief day in and day out. We live based on belief, of confidence in others, experience. We don't understand everything that we do, every mechanical thing that we use, but we live by it. So because it's accepting something as true and authority of someone else, in the case of religious belief, that someone else is God, who can neither deceive nor be deceived, but it's also free. We are free to believe or not to believe. And that remains a free choice. It's reasonable to believe, we talked about. And it's certainly open to anyone. You don't have to have a certain degree of education in order to believe. After talking about belief, then we began to talk about atheism. And the second week was about speculative, philosophical atheism. And I shared some of the great arguments in philosophy for the existence of God. And then last week talked about not the speculative atheism, but what we deal with more in our culture is what we might call the postmodern disbelief. It's not a speculative, active atheism, but it's simply people informing their lives without reference to God, just creating their lives without reference to God. And to many, you know, belief in God is fine. For some people, it's like a hobby. For those who want to do it, and it should be confined away from the religious, of the public square, keep religion away, and we talked about the problems with that. And so this week, after presenting the problem of the sort of postmodern disbelief, just sort of non-practice, not really focusing their lives, any meaning that's focused in any one thing, which is God, but in episodic meanings and so forth, I said we'd start talking about apologetics in this form, to this form of disbelief. And I am breaking it down. I said I call it transcendental apologetics. And I don't mean transcendental in the usual sense. It's based on the three transcendentals in philosophy. The three things for which we are all made, and we have no choice about that. We are all inexorably drawn to truth, goodness, and beauty. It's the way we're made. Now, we can choose one good over another. We're free to do that. Sometimes we do that in sin. But we are always drawn to truth, goodness, and beauty. So one form of the apologetics is the apologetics of truth. And in our culture, honestly, it's probably the least effective with the postmodern culture. But there are, I would say at the same time, there are a number of people today who are coming to the faith. They have read themselves into the faith. And that was not the case in the early years of my priesthood. And there was a dearth of Catholic publishing. There's a revitalization of Catholic publishing and Catholic apologetics, and we get people, many people, who read themselves into the faith. But for the population at large, we're mostly dealing with the people who really don't live by ideas, they live by images. This comes out of a media-saturated world. And so, for example, there's no real great political discourse that goes on today. It used to be sound bites. You know, a few seconds on CNN or Fox at night, a politician would probably try to aim for getting 30 seconds on national news. Now, the discourse is reduced to tweets, where there's a certain limited number of characters and name-calling. And where's the real deep political discourse? And people vote by images, they form their lives by images, and that's what we deal with in this media-saturated world. So that for this reason, the apologetics of truth probably isn't the place to start with most people. We're also in the postmodern culture of relativism and subjectivism, and the postmodern period is also noted by a skepticism, just a general skepticism about knowing anything. This sort of subjectivism and relativism about truth has been expressed by many people, but in the 19th century, the French novelist Gustave Flaubert said, "There is no truth, only perspective." No truth, only perspective. To which the Catholic apologist Trent Horn responded, "Is that Flaubert's statement true, or is it only his perspective?" And that is the problem with the claims that there's no absolute truth. Is that claim true? If there's no truth, how do you know? And we hear so much of the subjectivism, and that's become a very common phrase now. You see it everywhere. My truth and your truth. That used to be called opinions. That's what we used to call an opinion. My opinion and your opinion. And we would weigh them against something else called the truth. But now it's my truth, your truth, so or so's truth. And those are opinions. Those are subjective grasp. There is, we believe, objective truth. And in Catholic philosophy, we have a very simple definition of truth. Conformity with reality. If it conforms with reality, it's true. And sometimes it takes discovery to learn that, to find that. But that is what truth is. That we are made for universal truth is obvious on many levels. Any of you who are parents, you know that point when a young child learns how to ask why. And you get a question, and you answer the question. And then it's, well, why? And then you give more. And, well, why? And that goes on and on. It happens in religious inquiry. You know, the child asks a religious question, and you try to answer as best you can. And then they, well, how? Why? And that goes on. There's the pursuit of truth, the desire for universal truth. And finally, in a revealed religion, it's okay to say it's a mystery. It's a mystery. You can't understand it. Because children will just throw up their arms, oh, it's a mystery. They give up. But that's a legitimate answer in a revealed religion. We have to own the mystery. We have to bow before the mystery. We're not God. This quest for universal truth comes up in education. Yes, education is discovering truth, not creating it. We can't do that. That's the task of education. And Pope Benedict nailed it when he said the crisis in modern education is relativism and subjectivism. Because if a truth is relative and subjective, why bother to learn anything? You just got your own truth, your own stuff, information. It happens in research, that we're made for universal truth. We're never satisfied. Any of you have done any form of research, genealogy, scientific research, historic research, you know as soon as you get one thing answered, then you want more. I shared this 25 years ago. I went back to Ireland, and was doing some genealogy. And I chose at the time, I didn't identify as a priest. I just wanted to be another American tourist. And I met with the priest in this little village where my people were from. And it was hard to get records at that time because the penal laws, they didn't keep all the baptismal and marriage records. It wasn't written down. But it was just after the penal time and the laws were changing. And he found a wedding in the family. And he gave me the names. And he was so excited, and I was too. But then my next question was, well, does it say who the parents were? And he said, you Americans are all alike. I answer one question, and you got five more. And it's true. That's the nature of inquiry. That we're made for universal truth. We're never satisfied. Now, we have a caution about the apologetics of truth. And that is, we are dealing with a culture of skepticism. And Pope Benedict nailed this. He said, to many young people today, the claim to truth is heard as arrogance. They think that's arrogant. And so as we proclaim the truth of the gospel in the church, it's important that we own our limitations. While we claim to teach truth, but we only know what God has revealed, we don't claim to have all the truth about everything all the time. And if you look at the history of the church and the history of theology, it's like a tightrope. The church goes generation to generation. And sometimes in the life of the church, a lot of the laity, even the clergy, begin to embrace something that ends up being determined to be heresy. And the church sort of leans that way. It's tempted to go over the tightrope, but it never does. It stays on the tightrope, and it carries the faithful message generation to generation. The Arian heresy is a good example. One day, the historian said, one day the church woke up and found itself Arian. Many of the bishops, the laity, had embraced it. But the ecumenical councils straightened it out. So while truth is not subjective, it is objective. Our grasp of it is subject to our ability. St. Thomas himself said that we have a subjective ability to grasp it. Not everyone can grasp it as the others do. Not everyone can see it. So there's that element that we have to remember in our apologetics of truth. We must remember the role of mystery as well, and versus a revealed religion. And we're never going to get that cognitive, rational knowledge I mentioned. And here, Augustine, one of my favorite quotes from Augustine, Pope Benedict would quote it too, if you understand him, He is not God. If you think you've got him all rational and figured out, that's not God. As a matter of fact, one of my professors would say, once you think you understand a mystery, you've probably embraced a heresy. That's what a lot of the heresies were, trying to understand mysteries. That's what they were trying to do. I think it was St. Bonaventure who said, we know God best when we know that we do not know him. We call that negative knowledge in the spiritual life. Yes, there are things we know about God, but we immediately have to say, yes, God is good, and God is true, God is beautiful, but not as we know it. He's the source of it. He's the universal good, truth, and knowledge. So our Lord himself, of course, spoke of truth quite often. Part of the reason he was put to death was proclaiming the truth, especially in the Gospel of St. John. John 3:21, he who acts in truth comes into light. 8:32, the truth will set you free. John 14:16, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He didn't say, I teach the truth. I am the truth. I am the incarnate truth born onto the earth. In 18:37, anyone committed to the truth hears my voice. And of course, the antithesis of that towards the end of the Gospel of St. John is Pontius Pilate, when he talks about truth. And Pontius Pilate says, truth? What does that mean? There's no grasp of it. The second apologetics in the Transcendentals is the apologetics of goodness. This is about the actions to help other people, the soup kitchens, the clinics, the outreach centers. And as a universal church, it is often asserted, and probably true, that the Catholic Church does more to assist the poor of the world than any other group, any government or any other group, because we are everywhere. We're throughout the world. And we have churches and hospitals and schools and clinics and soup kitchens and all of these throughout the world. And antithesis of that, sometimes people will object to the faith. They say, what about all the treasures of the church, all the riches of the cultural things in the Vatican and in the churches, the great works of art? Why doesn't the church sell those and give them to the poor? Well, I've read, I couldn't prove it, but it's asserted that if all of that was sold, it would not feed the poor of the world for a single day. And there is a certain cultural patrimony that the church also holds on to as part of the wealth of the world that we need. The apologetics of goodness comes out in certain people. Our generation, our time, certainly admired Mother Teresa, St. Vincent de Paul, Dorothy Day, Father Damien, who served the lepers. Great people that arise in the church in the apologetics of goodness and show the faith manifested in goodness to other people. Young people today, not many by and large, are probably not as interested in the apologetics of truth as they are service projects, experiencing goodness and sharing goodness, and experience the association that comes with goodness, which is happiness, is associated with goodness. And it's not just a charitable works. It's just living a good life as a believer. I share the example from early priesthood again. A young man came to me when I was a young priest. He wanted to become a Catholic. I said, that's great. What draws you to the church? And he explained. He said, he told me about a relationship. He was dating a girl who was Catholic. He said that the relationship did not work out, but I really liked what I saw in that family. It was a large Catholic family, I guess built around Catholic culture, and strong, and he loved it. He said, I want that for my family. That's the apologetics of goodness, things like that. And of the Transcendentals, many think that in our culture today, there's too much skepticism for the apologetics of truth. There's too much cynicism for the apologetics of goodness. But as one of Dostoevsky's characters says, beauty will save the world. Bishop Barron, in his group for the new evangelization, emphasizes beauty. But that's not this week. That's next week, the apologetics of beauty.